The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Okay, this is the entrance to Kfar Charuv. I told you before that Kfar Charuv, which means Carob Tree Village, is actually patterned after, although not exactly on the site, of one of the villages that was up here in the time of the Mishnah, okay, 2,000 years ago, called Kfar Charuv, right? And what's interesting is they found carob trees and the remnants of a carob tree that date back about 1,200 years. So they think that this might have been, you know, there are a lot of carob trees in the area, and they think that this might have been close to where Kfar Charuv was. Okay, we are now heading north by northeast, sort of diagonally across the Golan, to the northeast part of the Golan. Look on your right, you'll see an Israeli flag, and you'll see a stone, a marker, Matseva. You will see a lot of these in the Golan Heights. Because of the nature of the battle and what it must have been like as the Israeli forces, sort of in total disarray, struggled to keep the Syrians at bay, they fought pitched battles and sometimes rear guard actions all across the Golan Heights. Now, for you and me, we're riding up here, it's a beautiful day, and the sun is shining, but an Israeli who was there comes up here, every crossroads carries a different memory. They hear names like Elal and Kasmiya, and Menachemiya, and all the names that fill the Golan. And they fill them with memories. A lot of difficult battles fought in these places. There was a fellow by the name of Yossi ben Hanan. Okay? Yossi ben Hanan was actually a battalion commander, a Magad. And he got married. And he married his childhood sweetheart. And they took a honeymoon and a little bit of a hiatus, because married life, you know, not so simple as an army officer. And they went on a trip. And they basically went to Nepal, and they were climbing the Himalayas. And they got to an inn at night, right? And they, you know, somebody asked them if they were Israeli. And they said, yes. By the way, look on your left. This is an old, abandoned Syrian army camp. Okay? This is a Syrian army camp. It doesn't pay. It costs money to demolish these buildings. It doesn't pay to do it. There was a period where they were using them for practice. Not live fire practice, because it's too close to the road. But dry runs on, you know, how to fight in a built-up zone. By the way, you can look on your left here. It's a good example of the beehives I was talking about, those white boxes. Anyway, Yossi ben Hanan comes into this inn at night. And so they said to him, are you Israeli? And they said, yeah. I said, wow, did you hear the news? I said, no. I said, well, you know, there's a war going on. So Yossi ben Hanan freaks out. They manage to get a hold of a radio, and he hears what's going on, and he and his new wife decide to cut short their honeymoon. He has to get back to Israel. He's a battalion commander. It takes him 3 days. In fact, they ended up having to fly via India, and they get to India, and the only connecting flight that will get to Tel Aviv, because remember, this is back in 1973, is a once-a-week flight. The only connecting flight that they have to get back to India is leaving 45 minutes after they land, all the way on the other side of the airport in New Delhi. It says by the time they get through passport control, whatever else is going on, they're never going to make this flight. And they're running, trying to make this flight, and they're lugging all their heavy knapsack equipment gear. Finally, Yossi says, forget it. Just dump it. Throw the knapsacks down. We're running. We have to make this plane. They throw the knapsacks on the ground, right? And they take off and they run after this plane. To this day, he wonders whether what happened to those knapsacks, did it become like it would in Israel, a chetetz chashud, you know, a suspicious object that they close off the airport. And they manage to get on the plane literally just as the plane is about to close the doors for takeoff. Remember that in those days they had like stairways up to the planes. There were no jetways. And he gets back to Israel, and he figures, you know, how bad can it be? It's after the Six-Day War. So probably this is going to take a day, and it's going to be mopped up, and he doesn't want to miss the war. because it's in the town. And he lands in Israel eventually, and his father meets him at the airport. And he says to him, is the war over? And his father looks at him and says, over? He says, I hope we're not over. And it's only in that instant that Yossi ben Hanan realizes just how serious this is. Now Yossi ben Hanan does not know where his unit is. He's desperately trying to get in touch with his fellow commanders, some of the men in his unit, his brigade commander. Remember, this is the day before cell phones. And by the time you were a day into the war, guys are either on the road trying to get to their bases, or they're out in the field somewhere. Nobody has cell phones. So he decides he's just going to go up to the front lines. And his unit was part of the 7th, so he already knew that the 7th had moved up to the Golan. So he figures he'll get up there and he'll find them. So he starts hitchhiking, and can't get anywhere. Eventually takes his car, it's a longer story, and gets to Nafach. Nafach is the staging base at the bottom of the Golan Heights. And he gets to Nafach, and when he gets to Nafach, he starts to realize just how serious things are. Because guys are being, you know, sort of gradually called up, and the reserves are starting to trickle in, and nobody knows what's going on. And there's no organized call-up, because everything's in disarray. And you can see planes flying overhead, and you can see the smoke columns in the distance. So finally, word starts to come to him that almost the entire 188th Battalion has been wiped out, and the 7th is fighting for its life. So he's desperate to put together men, so he gets together men, and he says, we have to form a unit. And these guys, most of them have come down off the battleground, and they're terrified. And one of the guys, who's a regular soldier, talking to a battalion commander, says to Yossi ben Hanan, you couldn't pay me enough, you couldn't beat me enough to get me to go back up on the Golan Heights. I came down from there, my tank got shot out from under me. We need to get out of here. And I don't even know why I'm still standing in Nafach. And at this point, Yossi ben Hanan realizes it's taking too long. So he grabs a couple guys, and they get into a jeep, which they commandeer, and they head up into the Golan. And he eventually finds his tank unit, and he takes over the command of his battalion on the fourth day of the war. And the stories of what he accomplished are legendary. By the way, Yossi ben Hanan is a famous figure. You may have seen the picture of the young soldier sort of wet and bathing in the Suez Canal in the Six-Day War, smiling in the sunlight, when Israel finally succeeded and pushed the Egyptians back and took over the entire Sinai. That was Yossi ben Hanan, so he became famous. And I'll tell you one quick story. On the first day of the war for Yossi, they were trying to push back the Syrians off the Golan, and his tank was hit by a shell, and he was blown off the tank. And he's severely wounded his ear, he lost hearing in one ear, and wounded his arm. And he had the medics bandage him up, and he got back in the turret of his tank. And the most amazing story about him is that about a week into the war, when Israel finally started to push the Syrians back, and they were on the road to Damascus, they came to an Arab village, I think it was called Majd, or Tel Shams, and they had to take this tel, because this mountain overlooked the strategic road to Damascus. So there was no way they could take it. A frontal assault was suicidal. So Yossi ben Hanan volunteered to take three tanks. They had found like a mountain goat road, like a path, up the back of this position. So he volunteered to take them up the back of this position and take the Syrians from the rear. And the Syrians actually spotted them, and a gun battle developed, and they were able to take out most of the Syrian position. But the Israelis had to wait until morning before they could attack the position. And again, Yossi ben Hanan was severely wounded. This time his leg was broke, and it was such a severe break that the bone was sticking out of the leg. And he was stuck in his tank, and one of the other tankers, his driver, pulled him to safety. And he was running in and out of consciousness. And then this tank driver realized, you know, this tank was burning, that they had no radio. So he climbed back onto his burning tank to get the radio off the tank so that they'd be able to call for help. For which he, by the way, received one of Israel's highest military honors. And he was able to call brigade headquarters. And Yamash Bengal was in the brigade headquarters sort of directing troop movements. and he heard that Yossi ben Hanan was wounded. And so he starts talking to this driver and then to Yossi ben Hanan, and he says, look, we're going to get you out of there. And Yossi ben Hanan says, I don't want anybody coming to get me, it's too dangerous. We're behind enemy lines, they know we're here, whoever comes is going to get knocked out. But Yalosh is a nut. And he starts talking to him about, remember that girl that you said that I couldn't conquer, and we have a bet, and whatever. Typical Yanosh. Anyway, Yanosh decides the only way he's going to get them out of there is with a helicopter. And he needs an elite unit to land in a helicopter and get these guys down. So, as they're having this discussion about how they're going to do this, in walks a young captain, who's one of the commanders of the elite recon unit in the Israeli army, called the Matkal, Sayyidat Matkal. And his name, you may recognize, his name is Yoni Netanyahu. Yoni Netanyahu walks in, and he knows Yossi ben Hanan, he was actually at his wedding, and he hears that it's Yossi and he volunteers for the mission. Takes his crew and he says, just get me a helicopter. Now, there were no helicopters back then for, you know, availability, because they were fighting a war. Every helicopter was fighting in the front lines. So Yanosh is desperate to try to get a hold of a helicopter so he can save Yossi's life. And just as they're having this discussion, the helicopter lands, bringing back wounded, medevac. So Yanosh, this brigade commander, walks outside, and he commandeers the helicopter. He says, I need to take this helicopter. The guy says, you're not taking this helicopter. We have to ferry, we have to get back. You know, we're in the middle of a war. So Yanosh, according to the legend, pulls out a pistol and points it at the pilot's head and says, I know how to fly a helicopter. If you don't fly me to where I need to go, I'm going to fly it myself. At which point, basically, they take a helicopter by gunpoint. They land the helicopter behind enemy lines. They manage to find Yossi ben Hanan and his driver and three other crew members. And then Yonah Netanyahu, realizing that there are too many men to get back on the helicopter, volunteers again, and he and two of his men simply walk down off the mountain in the middle of the night back to Israeli territory. That is one little story. One microcosm. And by the way, 3 days later, taped up and splinted up, Yossi ben Hanan is back in the third of his tank fighting in the Yom Kippur War. And that is one example. Yossi eventually became the chief commander of the Armored Corps. By 1983, he was responsible for the entire Armored Corps. And I know this because I met him, because when I finished the second stage of basic training, so I got this award. It's like cadet award, and he was the one they brought in to give me the award. And to this day, I regret the fact that I had no idea who he was. No idea. I'd only known who this guy was, what I could have asked him, what I could have sent to him. Okay, look on your right. You want to see an amazing sight? Look on your right. This is a Syrian bunker position. Okay? It's a Syrian bunker position. Every summit, every juncture, every strategic point, the Syrians believed in a fixed earth position, and they basically placed bunkers that were impregnable from the air back then at every position. So in order to take the Golan Heights in 67, in the Six-Day War, the Israelis had to take every single one of these positions. By the way, one of the fascinating things, you want to know the difference between the Syrian army and the Israeli army, when the Israelis finally managed to take over in 1967 some of these positions, they found Syrian gunners who were chained to their guns, because the Syrians knew that they would run, and they wanted them to keep fighting. So the way they did that was to chain them to their guns. The officers, of course, were nowhere to be found. Oh, Yoni Netanyahu became famous, somebody asked me, because in 1976, on July 4th, actually, on July 1st, terrorists hijacked a plane that was coming from Israel via Athens to Paris. The security at Athens was very lax. It is still lax to this day. And they hijacked the plane. They refueled in Benghazi in Libya, Gaddafi, and eventually they were able to get and land in Uganda, the old airport in Uganda. And they threatened to start killing hostages unless Israel released the terrorists that it was holding in its jails. One of the first things those terrorists did when they hijacked the plane is to separate people with Israeli passports and other passports with Jewish sounding names. They separated them, and all the other hostages were allowed to go free. Danes, Czechs, Europeans, whatever. The air crew of the Air France plane, to their great credit, decided that they would not abandon their passengers. They refused to be evacuated, and they stayed with the Jews. And it was a shocking reminder to the world that in the end, it's not about Israel, it's because we're Jews. Now, by the way, we're not going to go in here, but to your left is the site of one of the most amazing stories, unfolding stories, in history, the story of Gamla. Gamla was a city that became a fortress. It was built in the mountains. It sits on top of a narrow ridge with two very deep ravines on either side, and therefore it looks like the hump of a camel, hence the name Gamla, Hagamal, the camel. Josephus describes the battle that the Romans fought against the Jews of Gamla, and it was really a good example of the Gamla is really way out of the way in the Golan. You kind of wonder why the Romans had to come up here and fight, since they were marching towards Jerusalem. The Zealots who were in the area were determined to force the Romans to have to fight every village along the way, hoping it would deter them from reaching Jerusalem. So they forced the villagers to get involved by attacking Roman convoys, fighting pitched battles against the legionaries, until again, just like the story of Gush Etzion, the Romans decided that they had to put an end to this. So the Roman legions came up this road, exactly where we are, and they headed towards Gamla. And when they got to Gamla, they saw it, sort of from afar, sitting as a beautiful hilltop, floating as it were in the valleys. And the Romans surrounded the city. They laid siege to it. Eventually they broke through the walls. They built a ramp. They used a siege tower. Same thing. Battering rams. And interestingly enough, Josephus writes that of the 10,000 residents of Gamla, 5,000 of them threw themselves to their deaths rather than surrender to the Romans. It's a subject that's under a lot of debate because they've never found any bones below the city walls, but that is what Josephus writes. And the end of Gamla was actually a very difficult end, because what happened was, by the way, here's another example. This is actually one of the pitched battles of the 188th in this field. It's kind of wild. You drive along, and it's so beautiful. And you see fields, you see trees. You try to take your mind back, and you imagine, 30 years ago, these were fields of battle. And the only sounds you could hear were the clanking of armored tank treads. And, you know, Israeli soldiers gave up everything, fought and died here, so that we could do this. It's pretty wild to think about. But look on your left, and you will see, you'll see a half track as part of the patrol system. That parking lot, by the way, that you may have noticed, that's very protected, is usually an area where all sorts of devices, bridges that can be thrown across the rivers to head deep into Syria, something called the Nahri, which is a mine buster that you push in front of a tank to get across a minefield. And those things usually sit in that parking lot that we passed. And there's special units whose job it is to get it up to the appropriate place on the border if you need. However, because the situation was very tense a few weeks ago, they moved this stuff right up to the border. And it always makes me nervous when I see that empty. But anyway, so there was a guard tower at the entrance to Gamla. And the Jews used to guard the guard towers. But with the intense fighting, they were exhausted. And you know, after 30 days of fighting and arrows that were coming in at night, the Jews fell one night into an exhausted sleep. There was a thick fog that descended on the top of Gamla, just like we saw the other day. Two Roman legionnaires snuck into the guard tower and took some kind of a device, a crowbar, whatever it might be. Look to your left, by the way, that is the entrance to one of the most beautiful Nachalim, okay? The Shmura of Yehudia. Waterfalls, beautiful hikes down there. They're challenging hikes. I don't think this group is up there right now. It's a very hot day, but definitely worth coming back here, especially in the springtime. Yehudia. Beautiful rope ladder down through a waterfall. Unbelievable stuff. So the legionnaires basically pulled the stones apart, created a breach in the wall, and the Roman legionnaires poured through in the middle of the night. And the Jews, waking up from their exhausted slumber of battle, all of a sudden find the Roman legionnaires in their midst. So many of the Jews realized the Romans were upon them, they had no time to think about it. And they threw themselves off the stiff cliff walls to their deaths. Now, in the 1960s, 70s, this professor of archaeology, who was doing a teal in the Golan, and he came across this valley. And he knew Josephus. And he read saw the valley and realized it fit exactly the description of Josephus. So he went up on this hill and he started to find a few things, and he eventually got a grant and he excavated and they rediscovered the city of Gamba, again through Josephus. And it's an amazing place to visit. Hang on one second. If you take a look, you will see very clearly that we are passing through the ruins of an ancient city. This is one of the many, many, many towns and villages that dotted the Golan in the time of the Mishnah. Okay? We know of over 100 different villages and cities that Jews lived in up here in the time of the Mishnah. Now, the reason for this is very simple. It's because the Jews had no fondness for Rome. And they didn't really want to be too close to the Roman Empire, Roman tax collectors. Up here was a little more laid back. You were further away from Caesarea, from Beit Shan, from the centers of Roman activity, which were either along the coast of the Mediterranean or in the Jordan Valley. So up here was quieter, people left you alone. And many, many of these are mentioned up here. Interesting to note, by the way, that we are now east of the Jordan River, right? In other words, if you follow the line from the Kinneret, the Sea of Galilee, down to the Jordan, we're east of that. And according to the Bible, this area was settled by 2.5 tribes, okay, originally 2, Reuven, Gad, and half the tribe, Manasseh. Reuven, the tribal land of Reuven, you should have pointed this out, when we came down into the valley of the Dead Sea, okay, and we made a left, right across the valley there was the tribe of Reuven, the tribal lands of Reuven. Okay? Then we headed up a little further south, the northern part of the Jordan Valley, and those are the tribal lands of Gad. And then, now that we're in the Golan, these are the tribes of half of the tribe of Manasseh. Okay, the tribe of Manasseh lived here. There were also 3 cities of refuge, 3 Ari Miklat, which was a special city that was built for Kohanim to teach and learn in, which Jews could run to and hide in the event they had accidentally killed someone. And how that system worked is a fascinating system, but in a nutshell, they think they may have found one of them, which was the city of Golan. That's by the way where the name Golan comes from.
This is up here?
This, by the way, town called Keshet is called Keshet Yonatan. It's named after one of the boys who was killed in the Yom Kippur War. And it was built in his memory. Look on your right, and you will see, actually, that this is, again, the remnant of a Syrian position. Okay? You can see very clearly here what a battle this was in the war in 1973. Look on your left. This is a strategic position, and they had to fight for every inch of this road. The Syrians made their way down here. Okay, this was also called Bet HaMechas. This was called, this is where they collected taxes way back in the times of Turks. The Syrians turned this into, this used to be actually a village, an Arab village of Druzin, and the Syrians kicked them out when they took this over in 48. Because they wanted it to be a military zone. And that's why there's a mosque there. And when we took it back in 67 and again in 73, Israel made a conscious decision not to destroy the minaret of the mosque for obvious reasons.
Why?
We don't destroy houses of religion and other religions.
So, like, how come some places destroy Bibles?
Some of our people destroy Bibles? No, talking about the New Testament.
Yeah.
No, that's a different story. That's a different story. Islam and Christianity are 2 different things. Catholicism is different from Islam. The New Testament is equivalent to a Sefer Torah Shekatzav Amin. Heretic who writes the Torah scroll. Remind me later when my voice is there. Here you see a continuation of the army barracks. Only this, sorry, Michael. This is actually used today as an Israeli military base. And it's basically an infantry base. When the infantry is up here and they're called in as reserve, they sleep in this area. That's why it's still surrounded by barbed wire. There's a different road you can take. 73 war? Well, until the final ceasefire was about 100 days. But the heavy, heavy fighting was about 2 weeks. We are now already deep into the areas where Syrian tanks were roaming. And I want you to understand, this is a memorial for the 188th Brigade. And one of the reasons why this memorial sits here is because the commander of the 188th was killed on the ridge over there. Syrian tanks broke through here. The brigade commander was trying to get back to one of his units between two battalions, and he ran into an entire Syrian column. And they took him out in the night, and they took out his deputy commander as well, and nobody knew what had happened to them. Because it didn't occur to the soldiers who were still fighting that both the brigade commander and the deputy brigade commander, the Samchat and the Machat, could be killed. So they just thought they were down on the radio. It took them a long time until they realized they were both dead. And that happened because a fellow by the name of one of the commanders from Nachal Oz found them dead in their tanks. We had a lady who was on one of our Israelite programs who had actually made Aliyah and come to Israel in the 70s. And she lived in a kibbutz with her children. She ended up getting divorced and eventually she moved back to America. She came back in an Israelite program. She told us that she lived up here in one of the kibbutzim in 1973 when the war broke out. And at about 4:30 in the afternoon, on Yom Kippur, buses came into the kibbutz to evacuate all the women and children. And as they were getting on the buses, she was getting on the buses with her children, they could hear the artillery. And when she took up on the steps, she looked eastwards to her left, she said, and she saw Syrian tanks in the distance. She could see the battle zone. That's how bad it was. There were Syrians up here, but part of the military. That's why you don't find any Arab villages. Look at all the areas in Israel that we took over, okay, in 67, and there are a lot of Arab villages there. We didn't destroy them. Here you don't see a single one. The Syrians just got rid of everything and anything. They did not want Arabs living here. They weren't interested in Palestinian refugees. Now, by the way, look up on your left, okay? We're coming to a moshav called Alonei Bashan. The oak trees of the Bashan. The Bashan is actually the biblical name for the Golan Heights. Og, who was the king of the Bashan, lived and fought in this area. And by the way, this is the only place in Israel that you can go where Moses actually walked. Moshe fought and defeated Og Melech HaBashan in this area, but most probably a little further to the east.
That's the question.
Now you look at that, right, you look at that propeller up there. That's a very interesting experiment. Those are windmills that produce, they generate electricity. This is a natural wind tunnel. And so they're able to produce biologically, environmentally friendly energy. It produced no waste, no pollution, okay? And I'll tell you the most amazing thing. Why is that one lone tower sitting there? Because that one lone tower produces enough electricity to support the entire town of Alanea Bashan. And they have a deal with the electric company. The electric company's current runs into a river, an electric river, and the overflow from that production of energy, they give back to the electric company because they don't need it. And the deal is that if there's ever a problem and that generator, you know, falls short or breaks down, that the electric company will supply them of electricity for free until they can get it fixed. So they basically have free electricity. Israel's actually much, much bigger than the current borders of the state of Israel.
Why do the borders?
The borders of Israel are complicated because there's so many places in the Torah where different borders are mentioned. There's the borders that Avram, that God promises to Avram. There's the borders in the time of Shlomo. There's the borders in the time of Yeshua. There's the places Yeshua actually conquers. There's where 2.5 tribes decide to settle in the time of Moshe. So this is really more of a full-day seminar than a discussion on them. Look at all these windmills on the right. By the way, Israel is now marketing these. There are countries in South America that are buying these en masse. This could totally change the way we use energy. Now the only problem is they have to be in a place that's a natural wind tunnel. Right. If you go to Palm Springs, you will find this technology sitting in Palm Springs. Because Palm Springs is one of the first clients of El Nevi Hashem. By the way, you can see on your right now the blades. These are spare blades in the event that one of the windmills breaks down. Okay, now look up on your left. You look up on your left, there's a long ridge. Okay? The top of that is Har Avital. The right side of it, although the distance is Bental, which is where we're going, Har Avital is an intelligence gathering base. It's a closed military zone. And they have listening devices that can listen deep into Syria. They can hear Syrian politicians pishing in Damascus. They can listen in on, you think I'm kidding. They can listen in on radio transmissions. By the way, take a look at what we're going through now. This is a great example about how modern warfare, we're still doing the same things that they were doing back in the times of the Crusaders, when they built, you know, when Suleiman in the 1500s built those walls, because he didn't know the Crusades had ended, and those gates. Look how we have to make a right and then a left. They're actually dry explosives that are embedded in these piles of boulders. And in the event that the Syrians would get this far on the Golan Heights, at this point Syria is ahead of us, if they would ever get this far, there's a special unit that comes here, puts in detonators, and blows that boulder and blocks the road. And in the winter, these fields are totally impassable to tanks. Now there's another one. You see where that white bus is going? Ahead of us?
Yeah.
All right. So we're going to come to turn in the road. And we're going to come to another pile of boulders. You can actually see it off to your left. And basically the reason they do two of them is because imagine that there's a whole unit. And this whole unit is coming now, Syrian tanks, and they've broken through, and they're heading towards Israel. So what do? They wait until they get all the way through. They blow the one that's ahead of us. They blow the one behind us. Now they've caught a whole column of Syrian tanks between Iraq and a hard place.
Yeah.
And the Israeli positions up on top can take them out. However, the funny thing about this is that those boulders and those piles are actually Syrian. The Syrians were the ones who put those there, and they were intending to use them in the event, but they never imagined that we would get up here so quickly in the Six-Day War. But one of these piles was actually blown in 73. Unfortunately, the reason, by the way, that the war started in October of 73 was because precisely because these fields totally impassable because of mud in the winter months. October is the end of the summer. It's the end of the dry season. So it's the best time. The fields are driest, and it's easiest and most maneuverable for tanks. You remind me later, I'll tell you why, even though we think, well, whatever. The Syrians thought that this was the best day to attack, right? Because all the Jews are in the synagogue, and the military is depleted. The truth is, it was the worst day they could attack. And they didn't know this. Because if you're going to suffer a surprise attack, Yom Kippur is the only day of the year where you know with absolute certainty where almost all the men in the army are. They're all in synagogue. Israel's nightmare is what would happen if they attacked a few days later on the festival of Sukkot. Because in this country on Sukkot, everybody takes their families and they go up to vacation. So they're sitting around the Kinneret and the Dan and the Elat. Imagine they finally find you in the age before cell phones, 673. They finally find you, you're with your family, you're vacationing up in the Golan. And then they tell you to go to war. Israel's big question is, what would you do? Would you go to war and leave your wife and children to go home on their own? Or would you take them home first? See, there's another one here. So they would catch a unit between these two spots and pick them off.
אם לא אכפת לך, אני רוצה להגיע לבנטל מצד הזה, אני רוצה לעבור ליד המצפה על קונטרה, בסדר?
Now take a look to your right and you'll see a road. We don't take that road, that's a closed military zone. That road takes you to the United Nations post, and I'll show you that road in a few minutes from an overlook. We're going to get off in a couple of minutes just so I can show you something. We're not going to be off for long. You won't need anything but a hat and a camera. Okay? So first of all, look over here. If you can't hear me, come a little closer. If you look over here, just to give you a directional, this is east. Now, this is a UN base, United Nations base, okay? And that road that you weren't allowed to enter. You weren't allowed to enter there because of the UN base and because this is the border with Syria. That village right there, you can see a whole Arab village there, that's called Kunetra, and that is Syria. Okay? You are about, I'd say, 2,000 yards from Syria. Alright? In 1973, goes without saying, we're going to go up top and see where the war began and where they crossed over the border. So I'll spare you that story. But the Syrian tanks rumbled through these valleys. And eventually, in a counterattack, Israel took it back, and we occupied the city of Kunetra. Okay? And as part of the ceasefire, can you hear me?
Yeah.
As part of the ceasefire, it was finally signed with Syria, with Damascus. In 1974, we gave back Kunetra. Now, one of the deals was that Syria could not hold any troops in Kunetra. There are very, very specific, rigid rules in the UN disengagement treaty, right, as to how many troops you can hold up on top of the Golan Heights and in these areas. And the Syrians and the Israelis play the same games. Basically, they're UN spotters, and they every day have to count the number of troops and, you know, determine that the treaty is being held. That's their job. So Israel, like, sort of, you know, lets their tanks be counted here, right? And then moves them somewhere else, or sees that knows when the UN spotters are coming, puts their tanks under camouflage, moves them on trailers to another base. Then when the UN spotters fly over there, they move them back. And you play like all these games. But what was really frightening was that, you know, this is a whole Arab town. And Israeli intelligence keeps an eye on this town for obvious reasons. One tank that set forth from Kunetra could basically be in Alanea Bashan, which is up on that hill, in about 5 minutes. Imagine what would happen. Imagine what would happen if you're living in, I don't know, Boca Raton, Bella Kinwood, and one tank just comes riding into your neighborhood and starts firing. 105mm cannon shells, 3 heavy machine guns, 52 tons of hardware, a veteran of 60 tank shells. And one tank shell would completely explode this bus. So they keep a close watch on this. They started to notice, around about 1975, that there were an inordinate amount of tall, muscular men who were walking around this village. And it took them a while to realize that what they'd done, the Syrians, is they had a whole battalion of Syrian commandos, but they had them wearing civilian clothing so that the UN didn't notice it. And changed the troop movements here, because Syrian commandos are animals, and they're very proficient fighters. And to have a whole battalion of them, hundreds of them, sitting right here, changes the whole balance here. So they had to bring in troops, the whole story. I had a friend, Herbie Kavan, who studied Middle Eastern studies and became an expert on Arabic and in Syria, and he was part of a UN mission that went to Syria. And he, you know, sort of went in his American passport and had to get a new passport so that it wouldn't be stamped with Israel. And he went into Syria, and he was actually amazed, because at one point they took them to Kunetra. And they took them to Kunetra, and they showed them all the bullet holes in the wall, and they came up with this whole story of the massacre that the Jews had done in Kunetra. So when Herbie came back, he told them that he had heard this and asked them about it. So people started laughing. So, well, what they do now with Kunetra, right, besides the token civilians they keep there on one side of those, they use this for training. It's a training ground. They use it to practice fighting in a city, and in a built-up zone. And that's why there's so many bullet holes.
What is the purpose of the UN?
The UN's job is supposed to monitor the ceasefire lines. They're supposed to patrol and keep the Syrians over there and the Jews over here. And some say, what's the problem? Give them the Golan, or give them Gaza, and let UN troops sort of separate us and be okay. Except if you know your history, that was exactly what happened in 1948 and in 1956. 1956, Israeli paratroopers landed in the Suez Canal, because Egypt had closed off the Suez Canal. Okay, the Suez Canal basically is a vital shipping lanes that allow us to ship to the rest of the world. Otherwise, we have to go all the way around the Horn. And eventually, Israeli paratroopers landed in the Sinai, and they took over areas of the Suez Canal. But the British and French, who were also duped by the Egyptians, brokered an agreement, and in the end, we pulled back. In 1967, the troops massing on our border, Nasser announced one day that all the UN are kicked out, they're persona non grata, and they had 3 days to get lost. And basically the UN buffer zone just packed up its bag, got its planes and left, because Nasser said you have to leave. And that's why Israel doesn't trust these solutions. There's a Mishnah, it says, Im ein ani li, mi li. If I am not for myself, then who will be for me? At the end of the day, there's only one person you can really depend on, and that's you. Healthy thing to remember.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.